HRNradio.com, where positive people and podcasts unite.
Hi, everybody. Helping yourself to know how is why you're here with Dr. Greer, and you're listening to the Doctor on Call Hour at HealthyLife.net. Today we're featuring Shrink Wrap on Call, where we hear from the people behind the creative curtain, their newest endeavors, how their minds work, and what makes them tick. It's about what we can learn from the trials and triumphs of celebrity relationships. Welcome to the show. It's going to be a terrific one. Starting with my first guest, Vince August. I am so delighted to have this guy here because he is extraordinary and remarkable in his own right. Vince August is known as the Joking Judge, and he was born and raised in Hackensack, New Jersey, to Sicilian immigrant parents, the youngest of four children. Why is he the Joking Judge? Well, let's start with the fact that he's the warm-up comedian for The Daily Show with Trevor Noah, which is currently one of the top shows, and he's touring with Trevor Noah on his Loud and Clear tours. And here's the part you got to hear. He was a former judge and is currently a high-profile New Jersey attorney. Like, let's find out how that works and how does that go together. Vince, I am so happy to have you here. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. I really appreciate you having me on.
So let's talk about, I mean, judges are anything but funny. I'm just saying, the stuff you guys have to deal with, and lawyers, the stuff you have to deal with, black and white, that's not the law, doesn't work like that. Stick to the facts, ma'am, only the facts. How do you get the ha-ha, ho-ho, and turn that into the funny?
Well, I'm going to be honest with you. I hated when, I don't know if it was the New York Times or which newspaper called me the Joking Judge.
Uh-huh.
I hated when they did that.
Okay.
And the reason it bothered me at the time, I mean, now I'm over it. The reason it bothered me at the time was the last thing I did was ever, you know, specifically try to be funny on the bench. I mean, if there's a funny moment, you know, obviously you go with it. It's part of, you know, breaking up some of the tension in the courtroom and making everyone feel comfortable and letting them know you're not just up there, you know, as this mean person in a robe. But the moniker Joking Judge, to me, made it seem like, you know, I went into court with the intention of being funny, and I was anything but. In fact, most of the people that knew me in my legal life, when they found out that I was, you know, this comedian performing, headlining, opening for big acts, working at The Daily Show, their reaction was, really? You're good at that? So it was as much a shock to that business to find out I was a comedian as it was to club bookers and people in the entertainment industry to find out that I was a lawyer, nonetheless a judge. So, yeah, I never specifically intended or tried to be funny on the bench or in court as a lawyer.
You know, it's so interesting because clearly you have an innate, natural affinity for funny. I mean, that's obviously a given because it would just be who you are and how you interact and how you connect with people. It sounds like what you're saying is that, you know, the Joking Judge, it's almost as if you were making, or people would think you were making a mockery of being a judge, which is clearly not the case at all, or the law for that matter, right?
Exactly, because you know what? You owe the respect, one, to your clients, two, to litigants that come to court to let them know that you're taking their, you know, whatever their issue is, as serious as they are.
So humor is remarkable. You know, so many people, so many of the comedians will say humor, you know, laughing is the best medicine, comedy is the way out. I certainly know in the field of mental health, the things that clinicians would laugh about and poke fun at seem so dark and so black to other people, you know, whether you're joking about suicide or depression or whatnot. But it becomes a vehicle for coping with really weighty, heavy, intense, burdensome kinds of issues and the feelings that go along with it. You started to deal with that in the courtroom. When did you realize, like, comedy was superseding? Like, it's like a horse race. Here you are, a judge. You know, you're dealing with this profound career and sprinkling it with some comedy to lighten things up because that's what helps people move on and sort of deal with the reality of what's in front of them. When did you realize comedy was transcending the law?
To me, it never really transcended. It was one of those situations for me, and I try to equate it in terms of certain athletes that played two sports. I am lucky enough to enjoy both careers. You know, when I decided to set out on my own, the reason I did that was because I was working for a high-profile criminal defense firm, and I, you know, had a bout of consciousness that I didn't think it was fair to the partners in the firm that here I was running around at night. I wasn't telling them what I was doing. And it, although I wasn't lying, I wasn't concealing anything. It was my personal life. I mean, you know, I'd rather than go home to a wife and kids, I was going to a comedy club. It wasn't their business. But at the same time, I just this whole notion of living this double life, it became a lot. So I got rid of pretty much everything I owned. I sold everything off to open up an office and kind of scraped by to live both lives together because, you know, one was a means to pay my bills, which was law, and comedy was a passion.
Right.
But I never disliked, and to this day, I you know, I don't dislike being a lawyer for as much as people may say, oh, God, you know, you have this opinion of lawyers. You know, I have a tremendous relationship with my clients. I'm lucky enough to be able to, you know, say yes and no to cases, whereas if you work in a big firm, it's whatever they dump on your desk, that's what you're working on. You know, I've had people walk in my office that I'm like, no, I'm not interested in your type of case. Maybe if it's, you know, a criminal charge or a personal injury case that I don't think has merit, I can make those choices. But the people I do help, sometimes it's, you know, just doing a power of attorney because someone is not well in the family. It's working on a will, a real estate closing, helping people get their first home purchase. The divorce stuff is very emotional.
Right.
And I
right.
think I deal with people with white gloves, you know, trying to explain to them, listen, I get it. You know, I'm currently in a relationship with someone who is divorced, and our best friends are, you know, her ex-husband and his new wife. So, you know, I try to deal with people.
They work that well. They work that out well.
You deal with people on a personal level. You know, I
right.
tell people, I'm not a lawyer. I'm a guy who practices law.
Well said. So let me ask you this. So you're a lawyer and you're a comedian, and so many of the comedians do draw from their personal experiences, their personal lives, their personal happenings. Now, your legal career is part of your personal realm. Do you find that some of the material from your legal practice filters into or becomes comedy material? Jerry Seinfeld takes his marriage, his family, his kids, you know, what's happening in his life. Well, what's happening in your life is law. Does some of that spill into your comedy?
Never.
Really?
There's two reasons why. One, because I have an attorney-client privilege with all of my clients. So I couldn't do it. It would jeopardize my law license. And I certainly don't want to do that for the purpose of what could be a joke. The second reason is I'm very lucky in that, you know, I live a full life. You know, I make sure to travel. I make sure to spend time with family and friends, which is where the comedy comes from. I'm also, you know, a news junkie. I stay up with current events. I find humor in those things. So, you know, I read a lot. I have, you know, audiobooks was, to me, one of the greatest things that came along. Because when I drive to court in the morning, if I'm driving down to Trenton for hearing or out to Morristown from Bergen County and I have an hour in the car, I'm listening to audiobooks. So I try to fill my life with enough things outside of work, that's law work, to be able to find the funny in everything else.
Which is terrific. So now here's the next question. Everybody wants to be funny. Everybody thinks they are funny to greater or lesser degrees. There's nothing more wondrous than laughing and sharing a laugh with somebody that you care about. A friend, somebody at the store, somebody you work with, a partner. Doesn't matter. There's that moment of intimacy with shared laughter. But there is a distinction between your friend who's funny and a comedian as a pro. Somebody get like yourself getting up in the clubs, opening for Trevor Noah. How did you know, or did you know, or did you just feel driven and just put yourself out there that you were more than funny, you were funnier? You know what I'm saying?
Well, completely.
So how?
And you nailed it.
Thank you.
It's two different things. I mean, one thing is when you're funny with your friends, and I, you know, people, it's funny, I have the two careers that everyone thinks they could do. Everyone thinks they could be a lawyer, and everyone thinks they could be a comedian.
Right, right.
Because, you know, everyone has a family member that tells them, oh, you should have been a lawyer the way you argue, thinking all we do as attorneys is argue all day. Same thing with comedy. Everyone says, oh, you're so funny. See, when you tell jokes in closed circles with friends, you have to remember something. You tend to, you know, associate with people that you have a lot in common with, including humor.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
When you walk into a club, you don't know who's in that room, and you don't necessarily have common threads, but what you have to do as a comedian is find as many common threads as possible in as short of a period of time imaginable to get
right.
an entire room laughing. Now,
right.
listen, there are certain comics that go on stage that, hey, these are the jokes I tell, and if you don't get me, it's your problem. You know, this is my brand of humor.
Right,
I don't believe in that. I believe as a comedian, you have to hit enough broad topics or discuss topics in a way that everyone finds the humor. So one of the greatest compliments I had from somebody in terms of my, you know, political comedy is someone came up to me after a show and said, you know what, I really can't tell. What are you? Are you a Republican? Are you a Democrat? Are you an independent? I can't figure out what you are because you just kind of attack everybody.
That's open season.
Yeah. So, you know, and again, there's the common thread so that, you know, listen, I open for Trevor Noah, and if you watch The Daily Show, you know his brand of humor. I go on stage with a very different brand of comedy, and the great thing about even Trevor, you know, we hit both sides of the aisle. We hit both audiences in a way where it's just funny. You know, it's mm-hmm. not about just always attacking Trump. It's about pointing out just the humor
mm-hmm.
in all of it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, listen, Trump I find to be low-lying fruit in terms of comedy and attacking because a lot of times it's just to get the applause or get people, yeah, impeach him, resist.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, if you make fun of the political system, the coverage of politics, the reaction of people that's right now just so visceral. I mean, we're in an election year.
Mm.
This is the year we start deleting friends and social media platforms like crazy. So we're in that cycle. You know, and you have to find a way to break the tension.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's really a comedian's job.
Right. That's what comedy does.
Yeah,
you're absolutely right. No, but you're absolutely right. It's that moment of everybody's completely anxious and you know, like either embarrassed for the person or looking at them, and that you have to be able to have that line that just breaks everybody's tension and makes it funny so that people laugh and get it, you know?
Right.
And being able to do that, though, is a real art. Did you have that art skill as a kid? Like when did you start
no.
to be funny?
I wanted to do this since I was about 5 years old.
Really?
And oh yeah, I knew right away I wanted to be on TV and do the things that I was seeing on TV. The one thing that my parents allowed me to do as a kid was stay up late. I did very well in school. I always had good grades. So I guess they saw me staying up late was never an issue. And I used to love watching The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson.
Right, right.
And it was one of my favorite things, and I grew up watching TV, loving TV. Mm-hmm. To this day, I'm a fan of television. I mean, it's funny, when we go out to the Emmys, and I've been lucky enough to go twice with The Daily Show, I sit there as much as part of the show as a fan
mm-hmm.
of good television. Mm-hmm. I love to watch great acting.
Do you have
So I always wanted to do it. My Italian immigrant parents, when I told them this wasn't something that was a real career because, listen, they grew up during World War II. Television was not a thing, you know, in Italy in the 1930s, 40s, and 50s before they came to America. So, you know, Hollywood was this almost foreign place for them that we didn't understand, we didn't belong in. So it was never considered a real career, a real job, and it was something unattainable. You know, it was that those are stars.
Mm-hmm.
Those are people on a different plane than us. You know, we're workers. We're hard workers. We're immigrants. This is what we do.
Mm-hmm.
So they never understood that. So I, you know, was constantly told, listen, no, it's not for you. It's not for you. And you believe your parents.
Right.
Because, you know, they want the best for you.
Right.
So I went along with that. And, I kind of had this thing that stayed buried inside of me, and, you know, I always saved up money for acting classes, and then I took the bar exam, and one night I woke up in the middle of the night, and I just started writing, because it's what lawyers do, and it was just, you know, random thoughts, and then finally, after months of tweaking it, I turned it into a rant, and I'm dating myself, into a cassette recorder, a Walkman, and... Yeah, you remember those things?
Sure.
And
back in the day.
And I brought it to a friend of mine who worked at ShopRite in Maywood. And at night, the ShopRite would close, and there'd be a bunch of guys in there stocking shelves. And they were, you know, 12 of the most diverse guys, different backgrounds you could ever find. I gave it to a friend of mine and said, listen, you know, would you mind taking a listen to this? It's just me ranting for an hour. Let me know your thoughts. So he listened to it once on his own in his own Walkman. The second time he played it on the loudspeaker for the other guys to hear.
Oh, my.
And, yeah, now this is, you know, 96.
Wow.
I get a page in the middle of the night, again, dating myself, the days of pagers. And, you know, he says, give me a call. So I give him a call. He says, I got to tell you, Vin. He goes, we're listening to this. We're dying laughing. He goes, you know, where did this come from? So, you know, the next day I told him my story. I always wanted to do this. He said, you got to give it a shot. He goes, you got to do it.
Wow.
So, yeah, I didn't know how well to do it at that point. I didn't know anything about comedy. I never stepped into a comedy club in my life. I refused to go to a comedy club until I was either past there or booked there. I don't watch comedy. You know, as of the day I started comedy, I stopped watching it because I didn't want to be influenced by anybody or topics or material.
Right.
And so I took a comedy class, and the comedy class ended with a performance at a club, and my club that I chose was Caroline's on Broadway. It was a Saturday. It was a 6 o'clock show. There were maybe 30 people there. I went up. I had, at that time, what I guess was a very strong set. Looking back on it now, I would probably want to slip my wrist watching myself do that. But there was a booker there from another club who said, hey, we'd love to have you at our club. And
then
I went to that club, and then someone said to me, hey, you know, you should bring your tape to Stand Up New York. And I went to Stand Up New York, and it was Tim Davis, who was the manager at the time, and next thing I know, he said, yeah, you're really funny. Let's start booking you here. And it just started happening.
You launched. You absolutely
it just started happening.
That's amazing. Well, that's the kind of meant to be. That's fate. I was watching a special on Garth Brooks, and he was talking about he went to 7 record labels, and they all turned him down. And he was just devastated and crushed. And then he went back to the Bluebird in Nashville, which is, you know, the club to perform. And the guy who was supposed to perform second was out that night. So the club owner said, listen, could you go up in his place? He said, sure. He went up, he performed. And the guy from ASCAP who had turned him down like 3 days before came up to him after the show and said, I think we missed something. And a week later, he was signed. And so it's that kind of meant to be happening that happened to you. You know, here you just, first of all, you had the courage to share it with your friend. And the material and your funny spoke for itself. So it was, you know, the courage and the material combined was the comedy. Everybody stay with us. We'll be back in just a minute at the Shrink Wrap on Call show here at HealthyLife.net. Back in a minute.
Lighting the way with positive energy and love. HRNradio.com.
Welcome back to the Shrink Wrap on Call show here at HealthyLife.net. I'm Dr. Jane Greer. My guest is Vince August. You can find him at VinceAugust.com. We are talking about comedy and the law. Funny and funnier. So you launched this extraordinary career. I mean, it kind of sounds like it was a lightning round that happened. You know, you opened up your material, you put yourself out there, bam, you were discovered. Now, were you working in the law at that point? Were you actually a lawyer?
Yeah, so I started off doing workers' compensation and personal injury law at the first firm I was hired by. I had some disagreements with the partners there. One day went out for lunch and spent the afternoon going door to door, up and down Main Street, Hackensack, dropping off resumes. And I got as far as the fourth door before I got lucky, and someone said, how did you know we were looking for somebody?
Oh, for God's sake.
Oh,
you've got a guardian angel, mister.
Oh, I know.
Clearly.
And I said, you know, a friend of mine told me drop off a resume. And I got interviewed on the spot. I spent about an hour in there getting interviewed, and I was hired by one of the top criminal defense attorneys in the state of New Jersey, and I had no idea at the time where I was working. Yeah, it was Frank Luciana, who was 96 years old, still practicing law.
Wow.
And I started that next week doing criminal defense work there, as well as personal injury stuff. And it was the great thing about Mr. Luciana is he was trial by fire. My first day on the job, I was sent to Superior Court to represent a client.
Wow.
Here, take the file, go do, and I had no idea what I was doing. I went up to the first lawyer I saw in the most expensive suit, dripping with jewelry that looked like he was successful. And I said, hey, listen, I have no idea what I'm doing here. I've done workers' comp and personal injury. This is all new to me. And I showed him my file. He goes, all right. He goes, we have a similar case. Just kind of do what I do. And I was taking notes as he went before me. I wrote, jotted down everything I could. And then when it was my turn, other than say his name, I said almost exactly the same thing he said. I bluffed my way through it. And I went back to the office and I just started researching. I'm like, what the hell did I just say?
Oh, my God. Unbelievable. Yeah. But you know what? It was cold turkey, kind of like your first stand-up performance. That's really cold turkey for a comedian. First time you're out live in front of an audience, you don't really know what you're doing. You're just on a wing.
No.
You're on a wing and a prayer. And
yeah.
You had already had the practice for that, so you can really fly by your instincts, it sounds like, and stay in the air.
It's one of the big similarities between the two professions is you really have to be in the moment. And one of the greatest things I did in terms of both careers was I took acting classes, the Meisner Method, with this incredible acting coach, Joanna Beckton, who's worked with Ray Romano, Chris Rock, all the really good comedians that, you know, try to break into acting. And the one thing you're taught in acting class is how to listen. How to listen to your scene partner, react with the same emotion, react with, you know, that level of response and attention. And, you know, it was that type of listening that turns you into a better comedian, that turns you into a better lawyer, really turns you into a better person.
Absolutely.
Because listen, in your profession, you know the most important thing is not just hearing the other person, but you have to listen to them.
Really taking in what they say. And so many of my patients say, I'm listening, and they're not hearing
a word.
I'm getting concerned because we're going to be out of time in a few minutes, and there are so many things I want to ask you, but I must ask you, from being a lawyer, how did you become a judge? And also, was there ever a decision that you made that you regretted? Go ahead.
The second answer is easy. No.
No. There you go.
No. When you make a decision, it's because you've taken notes, you've heard the case, you know the law, and you believe you're doing what's right, legal, moral, and just.
So luckily, you're all in.
Appealed four times. Yeah, I was appealed four times. I was affirmed every time. And most of the people that left my courtroom, the one thing I wanted to make sure is that they understood why I did what I did.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it was a cop that I was dismissing the case or someone that I found guilty. I wanted them to understand the why,
mm-hmm.
not just what happened, you know, not just go pay your fine.
Mm-hmm.
You understand why.
So you wanted them to have a takeaway, a lesson.
Oh, absolutely.
Lesson learned.
I think I was really good at that.
Mm-hmm.
With regards to wanting to be a judge, it never crossed my mind. And, in fact, when I was approached by the mayor from South Hackensack, I thought she was calling me in to be a public defender because I was a criminal defense attorney.
Mm-hmm.
When she had said judge to me, I looked at her and I was shocked. And I said no. I said, I can't do it. And she said, well, what do you mean no? I said, listen, I also perform as a comedian, and I don't want there to be an issue. And, you know, maybe you should watch a video of my performance. And she said, no. She goes, we did our due diligence. We know about you. We know about your other career. We talked to some people. And, you know, the great thing we love about you is you're not Democrat. You're not Republican. The one thing we've heard about you is this is the most honest guy we've ever met. And that's why we want you. We want someone that's not partisan. We want someone that's just going to go do the job. So I said, okay. I said, you should really watch my video. And they said, no. And I said, okay. I said, well, I said, think about it anyway.
And wow.
It was three Republicans, two Democrats, and I was appointed on a 5-0 vote. And,
amazing.
You know, when the whole, and I immediately told the administrative office of the court I was appointed in January. By May, I told them, listen, here's my story. They didn't have an issue with it. Then somebody else got in trouble doing something completely different than what I was doing, and that's when, you know, all of a sudden there was, hey, whatever happened to the guy from South Hackensack? Now, I had already been serving for 2 years.
Oh, my goodness.
So, yeah, so by the time the story came back around to me, I went to my superiors and said, hey, listen, I was completely candid. I was open. I was honest. And they said, no. They go, we know. They go, we don't know where this is coming from. What do you want to do? I said, well, I've been doing this for 2 years. I gave up a criminal practice to be a judge to make a third of what I was making from my criminal practice. I said, I'm in already.
Mm.
So they said, okay. They said, so you want to fight it? I said, sure I do. And then the attack by the AOC and the Attorney General's office really got nasty and ugly. And that's when I started really putting up a fight, saying, no. Don't try to mix my character on television, my character on stage, with who I am as a person.
Wow.
Those are performances.
Mm-hmm.
And if you can't tell the difference, well, that's on you.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but don't try to judge me from some ivory tower. And here I was, a judge being judged.
Amazing.
Yeah. So, in the end.
So what happened? Yeah.
They gave me a choice. They said, listen, looking at the record, you did everything right. So we really can't attack you. So it's up to you. You could be a lawyer, entertainer, or you could be a judge lawyer, but you can't be a judge lawyer entertainer. So I resigned immediately. And I remember going to my superior, you know, Judge McGeady, who was the head of all the municipal courts. And I met him in person. I went through the back door of the courthouse because there was news waiting there for me. And I wanted to resign in person because he had my back throughout the time. And he got choked up. And he shook my hand and he said, we're losing a great judge today. He
goes, unbelievable.
He said, this is bad for us, but hopefully it'll be good for you.
Were you disappointed? Were you upset? Because you had gone into the judgeship sort of wide-eyed.
I was.
You hadn't coveted it. It was cast upon you. So.
Yeah, and I was disappointed that the Superior Court of New Jersey and the judges there, you know, this was 2013. I was surprised that they didn't grow with the times and realize we're in a different place. And then sure enough, you know, 3 years later, you know, a TV personality becomes the president of the United States.
Unbelievable.
So,
unbelievable.
We were predating that type of thing from happening. And my whole thing is, listen, morally speaking, you know, there was no issue with regards to me.
Mm-hmm.
It was just me as a performer and whether the public would be confused by the performance and whether they could differentiate. Meanwhile, 3 years later, we have an election and, you know, 49% of the country, I guess, if you want to go by popular vote, says, yeah, we can tell the difference. And we still want to vote for this guy.
Right.
You know, so it was one of those things where I thought the Supreme Court could have been a little bit more open-minded. But in the end, I've had too much skin in the entertainment business. It's my passion. It's a dream. You don't give it up for any prestige or money or anything like that. And listen, the one thing about the entertainment industry, I tell everyone, it doesn't matter how good you are at it.
Mm-hmm.
That's not necessarily the formula. There are Broadway actors that are beyond anybody you're going to see on television and film that won't ever make it there.
Right.
This is not a business based on whether or not you're good enough. It's not like sports. Listen, I'm 50 years old. If I can throw a ball 95 miles an hour accurately, I'm going to get a tryout for a baseball team. History is based on, you know, so many different factors. And one of those factors for the entertainer is just you love doing it.
It's the passion. You know, before we stop, I have to say that is exactly what Garth Brooks was saying when he suddenly loomed to such stardom. He said, you know what, this is what I wanted. This was my dream. I don't complain about it for 1 minute. The man is, like yourself, filled with such gratitude to be able to pursue your passion and reach your destiny, reach where you wanted to be. Vince, I am so thankful and appreciative of you being here and sharing really a remarkable life, experiences, yeah, professional life, and a fascinating conversation. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
It's been a real pleasure. Listeners, you can find more from Vince on Twitter at Vince August or on Facebook at www.facebook.com/jokingjudge/. When we come back, Maximo Sorrentino, actor, will be joining us. Stay with us. You're listening to the Shrink Wrap on Call Show at HealthyLife.net. And remember, send me your questions for the Let's Talk Sex Show at AskDrJane@DrJaneGreer.com. Back in a minute.
Give yourself some love with our self-care programs at HRNRadio.com.
Welcome back to the Shrink Wrap On Call Show. I'm Dr. Jane Greer, and my next guest is Maximo Sorrentino. Maximo, a.k.a. Frank Joseph Sorrentino, is a reality TV personality and luxury real estate broker. He's known for his reality TV show, The Jersey Shore and The Sorrentinos, and acting in films like The House That Wept Blood, I Killed My BFF, and Sleepaway Camp. To Maximo, it doesn't matter what your sexuality, race, or religion is. He believes we all have a voice, and it's okay to speak, and it's important to speak no matter what your voice sounds like. So we are so glad to have your voice here on the show with us today. Thank you, and welcome back. It's a pleasure to have you back.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to speak with you. Dr. Jane, you are truly a gem.
Oh.
Truly a gem. The last time I was on your show, you gave me such amazing advice. I feel it changed my persona and changed the way I do things. So I'm glad to be back on your show. Thank you for having me.
That is so kind. That goes right to my heart, and I'm so appreciative. And let's go at it once more with feeling and talk about where you're – let's give our viewers – just bring them up to date that what was – you were on the show, The Jersey Shore, with your brother. What was that like for you? And did you like it better than being in the movies or the reality TV? Like, which is your favorite?
Yeah, sure. So, the initial Jersey Shore seasons of 1 through 6 was the beginning. And I myself, as well as siblings, made some cameo appearances that did make it into the storyline of the show. And then I kind of feel like it actually brought us closer together as a family,
mm-hmm.
As brothers, because we got a chance to work together. And then obviously, you know, our lives are extremely public. What happens, in a reality television show transcends to real life. And, you have your fans who live vicariously through that. So, and then from there, obviously we did our own family reality show you had just mentioned, which was The Sorrentinos,
mm-hmm.
which was a bigger life experience. You know, I always say that, you know, we have different life experiences in life. Everybody gets a chance to do different things. But when you get a chance to work with your family, it could go either way. It really could. It could go in a direction where you're like, wow, this is great, or wow, this was not for me. But in our scenario, it worked well. We're a very, very tight-knit family. One makes it, we all make it. If there's one of us who has a problem, then it becomes all of our problems, as we all try to always pitch in and help one another. That's what a family does.
There's a real sense of unity and camaraderie and having each other's back, it sounds like.
You are correct. I mean, growing up, Mark, Michael, my sister Melissa.
All with the M's. Everybody got an M.
All M's. You are correct. All M's. It's like the Kardashians. They're all K's.
Yeah, right.
My mother did an amazing job. She's truly an angel and an inspiration to many. She's an inspiration to me. So, she put herself through school after having children. And instilled something in us that said, if you truly want something and you work hard enough for it, you'll be able to achieve it, and if you stick with it.
Mm-hmm.
And you had just mentioned regarding the camaraderie and the sense of unity, and that was instilled in us from being a child, from childhood, that, your family is your family.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can pick your friends, but you cannot pick your family.
Mm-hmm.
And in this family, there are no secrets at all.
Mm.
Something goes wrong, I could tell my brother, and 20 minutes later, I'll get a phone call. My mother knows it already. She may not have the correct story, because it does become a game of telephone, but she does have the story, you know. And then my other brother will have a version of it. So, and then it comes back to me to give, using me as an example, it comes back to me to give the truth and nothing but the truth. My version of it.
Does your mom ever take sides? Remember, this mother's brother's mom liked you best. When by the time she gets the story for on either you or Michael or Mark or Melissa, does she ever take sides? Like, would she ever step in and say, "Why are you guys? You know, she's your sister. Knock it off." Or,
you know,
"He's your younger brother.
Does,
knock it off."
She does. You know, she's very, very fair.
Mm-hmm.
And growing up, I used to, you know, joke around with my brothers and or whatever and say, you know, I'm mom's favorite. I'm mom's favorite.
Well, you were the baby, right?
I used to say that. I used to say that. But, you know, now I don't seem to feel that they, I don't seem to feel like they feel that way as well.
Mm-hmm.
I seem to feel that they know that she loves them, you know, just as equally.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're all different, unique personalities, you know, some, you know, larger than life personalities that, you know, have different characteristics. I think she loves each and every one of us for those. Don't get me wrong. She's the first person to call you out and say, this is wrong, this is wrong. And I even said to her, I said, Mom, you ever write a book and call it Mama Knows Best? Because you're always right. And she's like, you're just telling me that. I'm like, no, you are always right.
She's got that worldly wisdom. And
she really, really does.
Thankfully so, because with four in the family, that's a lot to be responsible for, a lot of kids to be responsible for. And so she really fostered the sense of you are your brother's keeper. You know, that it's not about you can compete. I would imagine there is competition since you're all in the entertainment industry.
Well, you know what? You know, we're in the entertainment business, you know, to a degree, and we, you know, also do luxury real estate and but you are correct. There's always that sibling rivalry that, you know, it's like an underground or a subculture of the family. But at the end of the day, we always, always try to help each other. There's not a doubt in my mind that if I needed anything or help or a question, I have several people to call on, and it's one of the Sorrentinos.
Well, there you go. Well, you can't ask for more than that. I mean, that's about as good as it gets, right?
That is true. You know, in life, you know, if you don't have your family,
mm-hmm.
in my opinion, then you really don't have, because family is a gift. You know, so if you don't have the gift of family, then you really don't have, then you didn't open the right gift.
Or you missed out on getting the gift that you really needed to get or really wanted. But on that note, we're going to take a break. Stay with us. We'll be back in just a minute.
Sure.
At the Shrink Wrap On Call Show here at HealthyLife.net.
What makes us different? You. Thanks for listening to HRNRadio.com.
Welcome back to the Shrink Wrap On Call Show here at HealthyLife.net. My guest is Maximo Sorrentino. You can find him on Twitter at Frankie Stiles, FrankieStylze. Maximo, you've had an incredible family life. It's a united family front. But you also forged your own separate personality when you were younger with your acting. So tell us a little bit about that and how that impacted on your life and how it continues to, you know, have ripple effects for you now.
Yeah, sure. So I started acting at the age of 8 years old. I was cast in a cult horror classic called Sleepaway Camp. And coincidentally, Sleepaway Camp is actually one of the first transgender horror films.
Oh, for gosh sakes. Wow.
It was beyond its time, the production of it, as well as, you know, the scenes or the actual theme of the film. So, you know, it gave me a chance at a very early age to, you know, express myself in a very artistic way. And then coupling going forward, you know, once you do reality television, you're playing yourself as opposed to a character.
Mm-hmm.
When you do acting. So it's sort of a switch back and forth that I had learned when I went to acting school in New York. But playing yourself, playing a character such as Peter Baker in Sleepaway Camp really, really did, you know, alter my life in a way as you know, there are many fans, you know, around the world.
Wow.
I get people who I meet, you know, sometimes, and they're like, oh my God, I saw that movie. Oh my God. I saw you on TV, and I just watched the film. So it's really, really nice that people are seeing the film, but the film has a lot of deep-rooted meaning to it.
Mm-hmm.
Fans are in for a real treat, just like most successful films or most successful television shows. Everything gets a reboot.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Sleepaway Camp is getting a reboot. That's all I could really say. The original director, Robert Hiltzik, I do believe has just completed the script, and I should be having I'm in talks with them regarding the next steps of it. So Sleepaway Camp will be returning for many fans. I don't know when, but that's good news.
Well, because it sounds like it certainly is that you were a forerunner with a message that was necessary to get out there, and a sweeping statement that has come to be so much a part of so many people's lives in the here and now.
Right. You know, at the early age of eight, you know, I didn't really maybe fully understand some of the scenes.
Mm-hmm.
You know, my dad, my father in the film, the actor, you know, he played a homosexual man who had an affair with another gentleman. And, you know, at the time of 8 years old, I don't think I put the two and two together until I was a little older and obviously watched the film several times. And then, and obviously I'm gay myself. So, you know, the film transcends, and the relatability to many fans who watch the film are truly amazing.
So for you, it became a vehicle for your own self-discovery, and being in a film where there was an acceptance of, you know, sexuality with a variation on a theme, as you were dealing with that for yourself, did it make it easier for you to recognize where you were and who you were at an earlier age? Because here you were in a film that was about honesty and openness.
You know, you are correct. It did give me a chance to realize who I am.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because when you're an actor and you're playing a part or role, you know, you have to assimilate to something in your own life in order for it to evoke the feelings, the emotions, mannerisms, so that the audience can truly feel the character. But you know, seeing you know, a gay father who has two children at a young age, and now here I am at the stage of my life where, you know, I'm single and you know, looking, I'd love to settle down and find Mr. Right and, you know, either adopt two children or you know, somehow, you know, have a surrogate and have a child of our own. But it does go back, as I always say, all roads lead back to Sleepaway Camp.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. It's fascinating that sometimes the experiences we have when we're younger become so informative and directive in terms of the lane we travel in the rest of our life. So you're single now. Is that, so many times people say, I'm single and they're happy about it, I'm single and they're not happy about it. The term just came out, I guess about a month or two ago, self-partnered, excuse me, that as if being single is, there's something, you know, like you're missing or you're minus. How do you feel about your status as being single? And, you know, again, dealing with the entertainment world.
Yeah, you know, that's a very interesting question. As, you know, I ponder that question daily, and I say, you know what, I'm single. I have my life together. I go on various, you know, dating sites. Right, you know, I'm sure you know, the world is, you know, all digital. Everything is an app.
Yes.
You know, everything is an app to look for my king. But I say to myself, well, maybe it's me. Maybe I'm doing something wrong. You know, so I start, you know, blaming myself. And, you know, I'm just looking for Mr. Right. You know, he has to be somewhere. you know, it, like you mentioned a few moments ago, being in the entertainment industry, I can tell you countless times where I've been talking to, you know, guys via any social media apps, and, you know, the first sentence is, you know, oh, very nice to meet you, blah, blah, blah. And the second sentence may be, wait a minute, you look familiar. I think I know you. I think I've seen you somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then, you know, that's their opening line, and I, you know, I'm always like, well, where would you see me or know me from? And they're like, oh, are you Mike's brother, or did I see you on, you know, XYZ show, or did I see you on Say Yes to the Dress?
Well, because you do look alike, you know, you absolutely look alike. And so the question is it, does it become easier or more difficult because you have a profile and you're a known entity to meet people? Do people out there automatically attach and make assumptions about you and your availability just because you are?
Much harder.
Yeah, a lead.
It's much, much more difficult.
That, I would agree with that. I could see that because you're a star. You know, you're a celebrity.
Famously single.
Yeah, well said. Well said. Well, we are out of time. This went so quickly, and I want to thank you for being back and sharing your extraordinary family story. Your family is an inspiration to everybody else. That family can really be first and foremost there for one another and for your own experiences. And listeners, you can find more from Maximo on Twitter at Frankie Styles or on Facebook at www.facebook.com/Maximo Sorrentino. And thank you so much, Maximo. It's always a pleasure. You'll come back again.
Thank you so much, Dr. Jane. Truly a pleasure. And thank you very much for your advice.
Absolutely. Terrific. And that is it for today. Join me next month for a new episode of Let's Talk Sex on the Doctor on Call Hour. My guest will be Amber J. Kaiser, who's author of The B-Word, and Jason Rogers, who's the author of The Thinking Man's Guide to Bedroom Anxiety. Stay in touch with me off the air at my Facebook page and on Twitter at Dr. Jane Greer. Remember to send me your questions for the Let's Talk Sex show at AskDrJane at Dr. Jane Greer. And thanks for listening, everyone. Remember, you can always get what you want when you're in the know.